Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. This was one of our top news stories last week. I'm going to read it verbatim for you. Connecticut fire departments are suffering from a severe shortage of volunteer firefighters. 80% of all Connecticut firefighters are volunteers, and most state departments are dealing with shortages. So, of course, that prompted me to want to get a snapshot for you. And what's interesting is not every volunteer department has the same story. So we're getting two perspectives this morning. Starting off, we're going to talk to Orange Fire Chief Vaughn Dumas. Now, much of Vaughn's life, I'm learning, has revolved around the fire service. He joined the Orange Volunteer Fire Department back in 2002 and rose through the ranks, serving as a lieutenant, assistant chief, and deputy chief before being elected chief in 2018. He's also a fire instructor for the Valley's Fire Chief Regional Training School and is a former president of the Connecticut State Firefighters Association. So, Vaughn, thank you so much for being here. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, I guess start by just telling us, Vaughn, before we even dive into numbers, how essential is it that we have enough volunteer firefighters serving the town of Orange, but even just across Connecticut?
Well, as you said, 80% of the state's firefighting service is volunteer. Having enough staff, trained staff, available to respond when needed is very important to all the municipalities across the state. We in Orange, as I told you before we started, fortunately we are not having this issue. We do have a pretty robust roster. We do have a very good turnout to all of our calls, whether they're 2 in the morning or 2 in the afternoon. And so far have been successful. I'm going to knock on wood with that. However, through my experience with the Connecticut State Firefighters Association and training with the Valley Fire School, I am very aware of many departments across the state who are having issues with getting volunteers to step up and join their departments.
In a few minutes, we're going to go next door to Derby and find out why they're struggling so badly with their numbers. I'm curious, why do you think Orange is doing okay?
You know, part of our roster, we are recruiting actively all the time, but a good part of our roster is successful in recruiting college students out of UNH who are going there for fire science programs. While some of them are transient and they come in out of New Jersey or New York, they are trained because back in their hometowns and home states, they are volunteers there as well. So they come in with training and some experience, and they do a reciprocity application through the Connecticut State Fires Training Academy, and they get their certification extended here to the state of Connecticut. So that is part of it. Another part of it is we're pretty proactive. Like I said, we're actively out there getting the word out, and we do recruit from surrounding towns. So if you live in a neighboring town to Orange, you can apply and join. And a lot of the volunteers actually look to be a career, and they kind of use it as a stepping stone to move forward to get a career job.
That was actually going to be my next question. We're talking to Orange Fire Chief Vaughn Dumas. And forgive me if this sounds like a jerk question at all, but why do we have firefighters who are volunteer? Why not make all firefighters career? Just to make sure, A, that we have sort of job security, we make sure that we're there. But also, really, the bigger thing is, to me, I don't think you could get a more dangerous job. It's interesting to say that we want people to volunteer to fight fires, essentially, to save lives. To me, why not give, you know, like every resource possible? I mean, it breaks my heart even when volunteer departments are trying to raise money for a new truck. Like, that to me seems essential. That should just be a given. I don't know. Am I making sense, Vaughn, what I'm asking you?
Well, there's several reasons behind that. Tradition is the first and foremost issue. There's traditionally volunteer fire service across the entire United States, and that is passed down from family members, being involved in your community. That's definitely one of the key factors. But another key factor that comes into play is municipal budgets. It is not really cost effective to go from an effective, like in my situation, we are very effective. We respond, we mitigate, and we go back home. And it would cost the town upwards of $8 to $12 million just to have three or four guys on, three or four trucks 24/7.
Wow.
So by doing that, I mean, we have a very robust roster. When we go to a call, we have six apparatus in orange. When we go to a call, we have, depending on the type of call or the time of day, we can have anywhere from 14 people to 60 people. So, and they're, again, it's volunteer. And then let me just add to that a lot of the volunteers across the nation receive some sort of compensation in some way. For example, in Orange, if you live in a town of Orange and you volunteer, you get a tax abatement off your property taxes for the home or your auto taxes. So they are getting some benefit. While it's not a career pay, it's not thousands and tens of thousands of dollars, they are getting some benefit to be a member and contribute to the community.
Do you guys have insurance? Like if you fall off a ladder or something like that, responding?
Yes,
to
yes. Okay, everybody is covered by their municipal workman's comp. I don't know of any department that's not covered by the town's municipal workers' comp. But we also have our own backup insurance plan as well.
Okay. I didn't know. I just figured, okay, well, without pay, I was just wondering if they at least cover that, which that's good. I'm glad to hear that. So I'm curious, in talking to Von Dumas, who again is the Orange Fire Chief, you said you guys are constantly recruiting. How are you retaining numbers?
Involvement. We do a lot of things. We do not only respond to calls, but we do a lot of things. We are one of the few left in the state, actually, that is a independent organization.
Wow.
So we don't operate off a municipal budget. We operate off our own fundraising. So there's more work for us to do rather than just responding to calls and maintaining our apparatus. We have to provide and do fundraising for our own budgets. So we purchase our own apparatus, like you said, standing out and doing boot drives, or our annual carnival is our biggest fundraiser.
Yes, one of my favorites.
And yeah, that's our biggest fundraiser, and that's been going for 90 years plus. Mm-hmm. That's how the department has generated the revenue to operate. And we do other things. We do boot drives. We do mid-year mailers to the residents. And we do other events such as the Santa's Helper, where we go around, we bring Santa to the homes and deliver gifts. We have pancake breakfast. We do whatever we can to generate revenue. And on the tax side of things, it's much cheaper for each household to contribute to our fund drives than it is to actually pay an annual tax for a fire service.
So interesting. Wow. Well, we appreciate getting your perspective, Orange Fire Chief Von Dumas. If anybody is interested in becoming a volunteer firefighter, I know we're going to dive into that in the next break, but if they're interested and want to reach out to you, or maybe they have experience from a past department, is there a way they can contact Orange Fire?
So if you're in the town of Orange or reside in a town that borders our borderlines, you can go on our website. It's orangevfd.org. Or if you are a resident in any other part of the state, there is a lot of recruitment across the state. Actually, if you go Everyday Hero, it's either on Facebook or on the internet. That's a recruitment campaign that's put together for the state of Connecticut. Wherever you live, you can go to that Everyday Hero site and learn about the volunteer organizations that might be close to where you're currently living at.
Chief Von Dumas, we thank you so much for your time this morning, and God bless you in the work that you guys do, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We continue the conversation about shortages among volunteer firefighters across the state of Connecticut. We just came from Orange, where numbers seem to be okay. But then a hop, skip, and a jump away, if you go into Derby, it's a totally different story. Joining us now is the former Derby Fire Commissioner, Mike Kelleher. Now, Mike is a 49-year member of the Derby Fire Department, having joined the Hotchkiss Hose Company back in 1972. During his tenure, he had the honor of serving as captain for 2 years, as well as a separate term as secretary of the company in 2013. He then was appointed Fire Commissioner of the city of Derby, a post that he held for 4 years until announcing his retirement in 2017. But Mike, still a very active member of Hotchkiss, and we appreciate you being on this morning. Good morning.
Good morning to you, too.
So, Mike, tell us, what's going on in Derby? Why are the numbers kind of not where we want them to be?
Well, I mean, the numbers are not bad in Derby. We have always have responses. Our men and ladies are always responding on time. And a quick response time as well. We do have members, though, who do live out of town. We're not necessarily have to live in Derby to be a member of the Derby Fire Department. And that's where we draw some of our members from. Matter of fact, the captain of my own fire company is actually from Milford.
Lives
in Milford.
Wow.
Milford that doesn't have an active volunteer fire force anymore, so they look for a place to join, and they joined the Derby Fire Department, and we're very grateful for them to do that.
Mm-hmm. So, Mike, would you say that, I know a lot of reports have said, you know, we know 80% of firefighters in Connecticut are volunteer, but we're seeing a very hard time, struggling numbers to get volunteer numbers up across the state. Do you think that the reason is because of the pandemic? What do you think is creating this issue?
Well, that is a reason. You're correct. It is the pandemic. And, folks, you have to explain to your family why you want to do this in the first place, put yourself in harm's way. And, of course, your family has to be supportive of that, and most families are. I do think, though, I think you can draw a trace to the downturn in enrollment due to the jobs, quite frankly. I mean, at Derby, as you know, is the smallest town in Connecticut, only 5.2 square miles. And at one point, we had a Farrell's factory in town, which had a lot of workers there. And in days past, in the 40s and 50s, they would let their workers leave the job to go to fires, especially during the day, 8 to 5, so to speak, when people normally work. That factory no longer exists. Those jobs no longer exist. And that, I think, was a big hurt because that was very helpful. I worked for the UI in Derby for a while. We had a Derby office, and I was allowed to go to a fire if there was a fire during the day.
Wow.
But the UI no longer exists in Derby. They're completely in Orange now. Their headquarters are in Orange now. So I think that has something to do with it, and the fact that people work from home and are not allowed to go to work, leave their job literally at home to go to work. I'm sorry, to go to the fire, I should say. Mm-hmm. So I think that has something to do with it. And and again, the time that, you know, men and women both work now full-time. And I think you can draw a direct line to the slight downturn in volunteerism due to the fact that the jobs, you know, people are more into their jobs now. They have to work longer hours.
Yeah, that's so true, Mike. You have such great perspective. And we're talking to the former Derby Fire Commissioner, Mike Kelleher. So, Mike, here's my question. If we have someone listening this morning, or we have someone who's related to a person who always thought of going into this industry, firefighting, what's required of you to become a volunteer firefighter?
Well, you have to complete, first of all, you have to apply. You can apply on our Derby Fire Department website. You choose which firehouse you would like to join. There's four fire companies in town, actually. Each one is limited to 75 members. I don't believe each one has their limit. I think there's room in each firehouse for members to join. And then you have to go through the same exact training that the career of firefighters go through. You have to become a firefighter one. That would be considered an interior firefighter to go inside the burning building. In my case, I've got some time in my company now. I'm in what's called the fire police, which where you would go to respond to a fire, but you would help direct traffic at a fire.
Mm.
We have a very active fire police force in town as well, which is all made up of volunteer firefighters.
Wow.
But that's the first thing I would say. You'd have to go through some training, and that also takes time. I mean, you're talking 6 months of training, maybe one night a week and one weekend a day, and one day on the weekend. For 6 months, and that's a commitment just to qualify to go fight fires, and so you really have to love it and have great community spirit to do that because it does take a lot of time away from your, like I said, away from your family, away from your normal life.
Mm-hmm. You know, Mike, you make a lot of really great points. I'm just wondering if we continue to see a shortage with volunteer firefighters across the state. What happens? I mean,
well,
I
know I do know that the current commissioner, Gary Parker, is working here in the Valley, here in Derby, with the other communities around surrounding Shelton and Sonia to work with basically, I guess you'd call it regional firefighting. Because we're so close. I mean, we have four fire companies in Derby. There's five fire companies in Ansonia. And you can drive for 10 minutes and go through three towns.
Mm-hmm. Right,
we're
it's so
close
true.
Together, Shelton,
right.
Ansonia, and Derby, separated by just a small river, that we help each other out. And mutual aid, it's called. And I think you'll see more of that, whereas each town will rely on the other town to help them mm-hmm. in times of need, mm-hmm. especially, like I said, during the daytime.
Yeah.
We have what they call rapid response teams, which respond from each town to help each other in case there's a big, a large fire or emergency situation. But I think the Commissioner Parker, the current Commissioner Parker, is on the right track, working with the chiefs at Ansonia and Shelton to bring this into a regionalized fire service, so to speak.
Wow, I've learned so much with you and with the Orange Fire Chief as well, Dumas. Yeah,
Mr. Vaughn Dumas, yes, great fellow.
Yeah, I've learned so much between the two of you, and I've gotten such an amazing clear picture. And of course, with my very own Christian right here. I mean, how can I not learn the most from him as well? I thank you guys so much for coming on and for giving such great perspective, not just to me but to our listeners this morning. And thank you for the work that you've done for so many years, Mike Kelleher. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I am that old. You're right. Many, many years.
Oh, stop it. No. You are wonderful, and I appreciate it. I think it's incredible, and God bless you. And seriously, the work that your department does and that all firefighters, men and women, do, I mean, it's a very honorable job, but it's one, like you said, it takes a lot of commitment. You got to love it. You've got to love it.
You have to love people.
Mm.
And that's, you're right. And you have to love, you know, and there's no salary, there's no 401k, there's no pension, there's nothing like that here in Derby. I mean, you have to love people and help people. And thank God we have men and women who still do, who mm-hmm. and do it all the time, 24/7.
Amen to that. Well, thank you, Mike. We appreciate your time this morning.
And thank you for bringing our attention to this issue. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. You're welcome back whenever you want, Mike. Thank you so much. Good morning to you, Dr. Cameron. Thank you so much for coming on.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for inviting Spring Child Development. Much appreciated.
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of times, unless you have a child who's on the spectrum, or unless your child is in a classroom with someone who is special needs, these are things that I don't think most people think about. Now, my listeners know I have a younger brother who's autistic. So a lot of the tips that you guys give out are very familiar to me. We never had what you'd call what looked like a normal holiday because everything was sort of tailored around Matthew in our family. So I think it's so important, unless you're someone who falls under that category where you live this, that other people are aware. And they're not big changes. It's not huge things that are going to ruin your holiday. It's just being mindful and knowing what could make a huge difference for someone who's on the spectrum. So I appreciate the help that you guys always give us with every holiday. And this one is no exception. So I thank you so much.
You're welcome, Melissa.
So let's start with understanding that some holiday decorations, like the holiday lights or even the music, could be very disruptive for a child. Tell us about that.
Yeah, one of the things that people really have to understand about autism spectrum disorder is that beyond the prime diagnosis of autism, a very high percentage of individuals also have a co-occurring anxiety disorder. So there's a heightened level of sensitivity in the first place in terms of different environmental stimulation, such as lights and sounds and smell. And then if you add to that, you know, an increased volume of people in an environment, then you start touching on the anxiety of an individual, and their level of tolerance just ends up decreasing as a result. So one of the things that I think is important for folks to understand is that sensitivities are different from one individual to another. If there's any listener on the line, for example, that has a migraine and ongoing problems with migraines, they understand that light and sound can impact them in a very profound way. Mm-hmm. Think of it the same way for an individual with autism spectrum disorder. Their sensitivity is different from many other individuals. So they are reacting and responding to lights and sounds and smell and movement in the environment.
It's just an overstimulation a lot of times, right? I mean, it's just that their stimulation is like an overdrive.
That's exactly right. They're trying to process what is going on, you know, from a visual standpoint, auditory standpoint, olfactory standpoint, and it can get overwhelming for the individual. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right.
I mean, and in some cases, Dr. Cameron, correct me if I'm wrong, but sometimes if that overstimulation just becomes too much, that could certainly lead to breakdowns or things like that.
That's what results in dysregulation. This is when you see an individual become behaviorally dysregulated. They may begin engaging in stereotypical movement, rocking, or making vocal sounds, for example, or lapsing into complete dysregulation and what we call tantrum behavior. But it's those are conditions where the likelihood of that happening just increases because of the level of stimulation.
And how long, Dr. Cameron, does it take when, if a child on the spectrum is like you said, you know, is feeling just beyond overwhelmed, they're starting to have tantrums or they're starting to rock, things like you just mentioned. How long does it take a parent to get them back to where they were prior to the overstimulation, if that makes sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And many parents have identified early onset of dysregulation, and they've got routines that they do with their child to bring them back to a place of stabilization. If a family has not identified an appropriate routine to bring them back to stabilization, those episodes can go on from anywhere from minutes to up to hours. So it's quite varied in terms of the range, which really brings, you know, the bright light on the importance of understanding how to regulate your child in the event that they do move into a place of dysregulation as a result of stimulation.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Dr. Michael Cameron, who's the Chief Clinical Officer at Springtide Child Development. We're talking about tips for managing the holidays if you have children on the autism spectrum. Now, I'm curious, Dr. Cameron, what would be a suggestion? So, for example, let's just start with lights, okay? Because with music, you could probably turn it down or even turn it off, honestly, when these children are in your house. But if you have an adult or a child who's on the spectrum, let's say you have a Christmas tree that's got, like, the flashing lights that will change colors or things like that. What would be your suggestion? Do you set it to a mode where it's just one color? Do you shut the lights off? Like, do you have that conversation with a guest before they come with their child? What would you suggest?
Preparation, preparation, preparation. I cannot emphasize that enough. There's some really great ways in supporting individuals with autism spectrum disorder, just letting them know what is going to happen. One method is what's referred to as a social story, which is a narrative-based intervention. So depending on the level of the child, you can talk them through just exactly what's going on. I mean, everybody in this room, you don't have to have a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. Everybody in this room understands what it's like not to be prepared for something and the anxiety that can provoke. So ways to do that is by narrative-based intervention, talking somebody through what is going to occur. An intervention I use a lot is what's referred to as a talking photo album, where you can actually take pictures and the photo album itself has a button that can be depressed and it provides some voice output in terms of a story that needs to unfold. So the talking photo album, even YouTube videos, you know, if you know that the child is going to be exposed to flashing lights or any other kind of visual stimulation, giving that individual exposure on YouTube and talking them through while they're looking at the YouTube video is something that can be done in preparation for these kinds of activities. Because the worst thing that can happen is that the person with autism gets surprised. They're not expecting something. Something occurs, and then dysregulation occurs as a result. So talking photo albums are fantastic. Social stories are fantastic, which is just a talk through, a narrative-based intervention. YouTube videos can be used for preparation as well. But I just can't emphasize that enough, Melissa, that, you know, the preparation of an individual, letting them know what's going to happen, what that's going to look like, and just not surprising the person.
Mm-hmm. We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Michael Cameron. He is the Chief Clinical Officer at Springtide Child Development, talking about tips for managing the holidays with children on the autism spectrum. So I wanted to dive into this with you, Dr. Cameron, going to the mall, I would imagine you and I were just talking about overstimulation. Well, forget even the lights and the sounds. Let's talk about the crowds and what that could mean for somebody who's autistic. What would be your suggestion if you need to get that shopping done, but you have a child on the spectrum?
Yeah, Melissa, we're within the Festival of Hanukkah and within the Christmas season, and at this point, families are bringing their children into crowded areas and places with increased volume. And one of the things I want to touch on is social interactions, and then I can talk about the stimulation as well of malls. But from a social standpoint, one of the things that is really important for a child is to have a sense of control over social interaction. So people with autism spectrum disorder are indeed on a spectrum, and that means that they range from individuals who are nonverbal, they don't have a voice to express what their preferences are necessarily, to individuals that are quite verbal. So giving that individual the opportunity to indicate what their preference is for social interaction is important. So for a person that's nonverbal, for example, using a picture-based system or even assistive technology, just ensuring that that person has the control over what social interaction looks like is going to be essential. We're still in the grip of COVID, and one of the things that we know is that people will present themselves in varied formats, with a mask, without a mask. That child may have a specific preference as well in terms of how that person presents. So giving that child the capability of indicating whether they just want a simple hello, whether they want a high five, whether they want a hug, or just a brief interaction is critical. The locus of control has to be within the child. So preparation for that is essential, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And from a crowd standpoint, once again, preparation of a family in terms of communicating the importance of proximity and that child maintaining close proximity to an adult is essential. So for that reason, one of the things that I do is have a parent, for example, or a caregiver, bring a lot of preferred activities with them in the context of walking through a mall, just so that there's a reason for that child to remain close in proximity to an adult, because if they drift off, obviously there's danger in terms of that child getting lost, or mm-hmm. there's also a danger of elopement.
Mm-hmm. No question. And Dr. Cameron, I was going to say preparation seems to be one of the key things you continue to come back to. Let's talk about large gatherings or family events. There are a couple things I see here, like if you have a picky eater or if you have a child who just has specific things that they like to do. What would you recommend a parent bring with them to those gatherings? And is it seen as being rude if you bring it with you? I would think not. I would hope people understand.
Yeah, it's a time of year for community and connection. And when there are things that need to be brought to, let's say a family is going to a relative's house, for example, calling ahead and just explaining just what you're going to do and why you're doing it just goes a very long way. Many people can find it a little off-putting if somebody is not eating the food that is being served, and that's an outcome that you don't want. So just calling ahead and letting them know just goes a long way in terms of maintaining relationships. And then for the child themselves, just bringing the preferred food that they like, that they're accustomed to, that they have familiarity with, is absolutely essential, because if you're not doing that, then that child's experience can be different and unfavorable, and that's not something that anybody wants during this time of year.
Mm-hmm. And the most important thing is, if you want that family to show up, you'll accommodate them. It's not a big deal. Preparation, preparation, preparation. Dr. Michael Cameron, we've learned so much. He's the Chief Clinical Officer at Springtide Child Development, and there are multiple locations in Connecticut. In fact, the closest one to us, I believe, is in Trumbull. If you want to learn more or contact Springtide Child Development, you can go to myspringtide.com. And Dr. Cameron, we thank you so much for coming on this morning. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for inviting Springtide. Happy holidays to you and your audience.
Thank you. And to you, too. Every week you hear on the show Pet of the Week, which is brought to you by the Connecticut Humane Society. And we love that segment because it tells you about adoptable pets right here in our listening area. But this morning I wanted to talk about adoptable pets and how it could be a danger if you're just adopting because of the holiday season. Joining me this morning is Susan Walschlager, who's with the Connecticut Humane Society. Susan pops on from time to time, and I'm so grateful you could be here this morning. Good morning, Susan. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. You know, I thought of this topic because typically I'll talk to you or Bliss around Easter when people want to buy ducks and bunnies, and you guys see a slew of rabbits essentially brought in to the Humane Society because people think, oh, they're so cute and they're so little and this is so wonderful. But then a month or two later, they realize those really cute little animals turn out being really big responsibilities, both in size and in cost and everything else. And I thought, you know, why don't we do this around the holidays in December? So I thought it'd be a great time to talk about it this morning. First of all, what would be your recommendation to people if they're thinking, hey, it'd be great to put a puppy or a kitten or a bunny or a ferret under the tree for this Christmas?
Well, I think the number one important thing is to not get a pet for someone as a surprise. We'll sometimes hear from people, you know, now or even throughout the year, well, so-and-so has been talking about wanting a pet. I want to get one for them as a surprise. I want to get one as a surprise for my mom or dad. And we don't adopt out pets as gifts or surprises. The person who's going to be taking care of that pet every single day needs to be the one to choose it because they need to be, you know, aware of everything that it entails to care for a pet for many years to come. Mm-hmm. And so you really want the person who's going to be the owner to choose the pet to go in with all the information that they need to take care of that pet, because you might not be aware of an allergy in that person's household, or they might not have the financial or scheduled, you know, time commitment to be able to care for that pet right now. So that's something that's really important to think about. And if you're a parent who's getting one for the kiddos, of course, you're the one who's making the decision if they, you know, put an animal on their wish list for the holidays. But you really have to think about that pet, how it fits into your life far beyond the holidays. And you don't want to put that deadline of Christmas or whatever holiday on yourself, because that just adds so much pressure that you don't need, especially right now.
No question. And exactly what you just said, Susan, I think you should plan when you want to get, if you want to get a pet for your kids, think of it as you're getting a pet for yourself, because it is going to fall on you. I don't care if your kid is 15 and they're responsible at school. I promise you, it's those early mornings, it's going to fall on you, the parent. It really is. It's true.
Yeah, yeah, that's another thing I've been reminding people of. It, you know, it's another thing we hear from people. They say, well, my kid didn't want to take care of it. They had wanted it. But yeah, it does fall to us as the grown-ups. And, you know, think about ourselves. Sometimes at the end of the day, we're even like, oh, I have to clean the litter box right now, you know? And
right.
You kind of get, you're like, oh, I'm tired. I've had a long day, but it has to be done. And so imagine your kids, they also are going to start to feel like that maybe. And it is going to fall to you. And so you have to remember about all those responsibilities. You have to fit into your schedule. And, you know, the holidays, you might not have a routine right now because things are a little bit more hectic. So think about your routine after the holidays, how the pet is going to fit into that. What happens when everyone is back at work, back at school, or you're on vacation? Who's taking care of the animal? Just have a plan.
So true. And we're talking to Susan this morning with the Connecticut Humane Society. Some of the dangers. Now, I don't want to turn everybody off like you shouldn't do this. But, you know, there are some dangers to adopting a pet for Christmas, for example, putting it under the tree. I know of some people, you know, it's funny, Susan, you talk about the surprises. So a friend of mine surprised her grandmother for Hanukkah last week with a dash hound puppy, or a basset hound puppy. The grandmother's ecstatic, right? Oh my gosh, this is so wonderful, so wonderful. But then she realized that the basset hound is going to grow, like exponentially grow. And she's got this little one bedroom apartment, and she realized, well, where am I going to put this dog? Where do I? This isn't even fair humanely to put this dog in this one bedroom apartment with me. And so she had to give the dog back a week after Hanukkah.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So,
what we want to prevent. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, devastating. Like, I felt awful for this woman, but I was just curious, you know, talk about that aspect that, you know what? I know it sounds crazy, but we're thinking in the immediate future, oh, we have this little kitten, we have this little puppy, and this is wonderful. But I'm sorry, in about 6 months to a year, that little thing is now maybe 20, 30, if it's a dog, like we have a golden now, 80 pounds a year later. you have to think about that. You know what I'm saying?
What I like to tell people about is my experience of adopting a puppy just as winter started. And you're working on housebreaking when it's snowing, when it's 30 degrees out.
That's
and
true,
so,
too.
You know, you have to consider the time of year, even when it's not just the holidays. But it's a lot to think about. You want to do your research. You want to look at breeds, breed mixes, what special care they might need. But that's also a great example of why you want the person who will be taking care of the pet to be involved. You want them to choose and find that connection with a pet and see that moment that they find the one that's for them, because that's amazing, right? So you can offer as a surprise and say, oh my goodness, here's my gift. I want to pay for an adoption fee for you. Let me help you with the process.
That's a great idea. Oh, I love that, Susan. That's a great idea.
You know, you can do that in a card, or you can wrap up pet supplies, bowls, leash, cat litter box, whatever it might be, and say, this is part of what I want to help you with. I want to, you know, surprise you by helping you with the adoption process and look online at the shelters and help you with the application or whatever it might be. So you could still surprise them in these other ways, but they still get to be a part of the process, or the main part of the process, and actually choose the pet that they form a connection with.
I think that's such a great idea. Especially, like, you don't even think about that either. You know, sometimes we're so focused on actually getting the animal that you don't realize the food and the bowls and the leashes and the cat litter boxes and whatever else you need. That you got to pay for that, too. that's got to come, too.
Yeah.
So it's a good idea.
Vet care, exactly. Yep.
Oh, the vet care, sure.
If people do decide now is the right time for themselves to get a pet, something that's important to start right now, get them into that routine. Even if your routine might be a little bit all over the place because of the time of year that it is, make sure that pet is on a routine, because that's going to help them just flow with the family after the holidays and beyond. So that mealtime routine, the walk for the dog the same time of day when you're cleaning those litter boxes, that helps them to settle in, to feel safe, to know what to expect. And that's going to help you far beyond this time of year.
Susan Walshlager, we appreciate having you here this morning with the Connecticut Humane Society. Thank you so much. And hopefully we only have adoptions that are going to stick for this holiday season. I hope that continues to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And if people aren't able to adopt right now, they can always make a donation at cthumane.org and help the pets in other ways.
Yeah, and they can certainly see who's also adoptable at cthumane.org, correct?
That's right. All the pets who are ready for families currently are up there with profiles and who they're looking for their new life.
Susan, thank you so much for taking the time. We appreciate it. And we'll see you for Pet of the Week later this week.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right.